For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics with ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel and Republican political consultant Neva Hill. A committee meeting to investigate sexual harassment claims hits a speed bump on its very first day. Democratic Representative David Perryman walked out, refusing to sign a confidentiality agreement. The Rules Committee plans to investigate accusations against Tulsa Republican Dan Kirby and Stillwell Democrat Will Forkiller. Ryan, what is Perryman's complaint about this confidentiality agreement?
Well, I think his complaint is a valid one, and it's essentially that the confidentiality agreement that members of this committee are being asked to sign is way too broad. I mean, it would essentially prevent the committee members from discussing anything, including their findings about the Oklahoma House of Representatives' ability and legal ability to pay a settlement of this sort. And, you know, one of the things that is troubling about this is that, you know, we talk about these confidentiality agreements and then some of the backstory on, you know, who did what. But what is even more troubling is the fact that in an age where we have elected a misogynist as president and women who already have to deal with sexual harassment on a daily basis, that the Oklahoma House of Representatives essentially fired somebody for coming forward. At least that's the apparent takeaway at this point. I think that House leadership, in the midst of all of this, needs to come forward and say that they're going to protect employees, men and women, but in particular women, that come forward with allegations of sexual harassment, and they don't have to worry about retaliation.
Neva?
Well, I think when we look at this committee, first of all, let's set it up with the fact that the new House Speaker made it clear that that they wanted to have a process and an investigation and come out with the findings that would be made public. Now, the argument on whether this document was too broad, as you say, Ryan, that members didn't want to sign or others, that's debatable. I think the point that Representative O'Donnell made, that where he drew similarities to executive sessions that are convened by other government entities, when you're in an investigative process, there are some things that clearly probably should be at least initially behind closed doors to protect witnesses who may be unelected folks that are brought before the committee to reveal whatever they may know about the situation. So I think it's less about the shroud of secrecy, which makes a great headline and makes for great fodder, and it's more about giving a process time to work and let these folks find out. It's incumbent upon them to get to the bottom of what's going on, what's been paid, who is responsible, who has committed any wrongdoing, and act accordingly. And they have a variety of methods and procedures that they may act on as a body once these results come forward. So I think we're at the beginning of the process. I think we need to let it take time to move forward. And then if it hits another speed bump where they don't really do their due diligence and don't get this work done, then the public definitely has every reason to be as outraged about that as they clearly have been about the fact that 44,000 or 44,500, whatever the number was paid for one of these particular lawsuits.
But it seems it's also important that the public know about it, and there was a lot of talk about not letting the press in, and of course the gag order that kind of causes some problems if the public doesn't even know what's going on.
There is a process, and there's always going to be this tension in trying to make sure that the information is available, mm-hmm. and that there is transparency. But there also has to be some process for a committee to work where they can actually get a proper airing of all of the information in a way that they really do get the facts and find out what really did happen and who was involved.
And again, we've got this outrage over the $40,000+ that was paid out in settlement. But the bigger outrage here should be the fact that underlying the settlement was an employee who was terminated because she came forward with an allegation of sexual harassment. And that's the biggest deal here. We have to have assurances for these employees that if they come forward with whether they're uncomfortable or whether they're in a dangerous situation.
And I don't think there's been any indication that there is not total agreement. I think in a nonpartisan fashion with folks saying yes, that we do need to create an environment that is not a hostile environment where people do have the kind of workplace where everyone expects, not only in the private sector but certainly in a government body and at the state capitol. That's going to take place. So I think everyone is, without regard to party, without regard to anything else, is going to be very, very, very focused on making that happen.
we are only about 3.5 weeks away from Governor Fallon giving her State of the State address. Fallon will also provide a budget recommendation, which includes a shortfall of nearly $870 million. Neva, how do you think she will try to fill this hole?
Well, I think that's going to be a big question.
Besides, and
there's
very
a lot. There's a lot of speculation. I mean, you know, the wishful thinking, of course, is that oil and gas will rebound and it will do it quickly enough that that it will have some impact on the budget in short order. Generating new revenue is the $64,000 question. Will this new legislature come in and will they really seriously look at things like the cigarette tax again, or looking at some eliminating some of the sales tax exemptions, some of the things that have been talked about time and again? Will there be more pressure? Will there be more intention on the part of some of these new lawmakers coming in to really step up and say, let's quit playing the politics and let's look at some of these things and really address them in a significant way? So I think for the governor, I mean, I think when it's clear that that there is again this big hole, and we're going to have this added pressure of everyone, you know, coming in needing more money, not less. What do they do? And I think this is a time where I think we'll really see, probably for the first time in years, a legislature with enough new folks that will have an opportunity to see if they really want to kind of shift their focus on how they address these issues.
A 3/4 vote still needed to raise taxes. Ryan, even though they got a super majority in the House and Senate, do you think there's a possibility they're going to raise taxes in this session?
Well, I mean, are they going to raise the right taxes, I think, is the better question. I mean, you know, certainly, you know, fuel taxes on the table. We haven't raised that since 1987. We're 47th in the nation in terms of the amount that we tax fuel consumption. So that's a good start. You know, cigarette taxes, the governor's talked about taxing tattoos, you know, all of these. These are all, you know, these taxes that we can raise that will do some work to fill our budget hole. But let's face it, I mean, we're nearly $900 million off. You know, since 2009, agencies have almost across the board have taken a 20% cut. So we start at around a 20% cut anyways, right? And then we add on to that with these further cuts. Neva's right. You know, we can cross our fingers and hope that we've got a rebound in the oil and gas markets. But even if we have that, we have a revenue problem that goes beyond oil and gas collections. And it's a revenue problem created by tax cuts through income taxes and to cuts to the oil and gas community through gross production taxes that has really driven us into this hole. So unless legislators really get serious about talking about revenue increasing measures that look at income tax and not just taxes on fuel or even, you know, service taxes or sales taxes that would disproportionately affect lower and middle income Oklahomans, but really look at those income tax and take on the powerful political interest in the oil and gas community, we're not really going to get close to closing that budget gap that we see right now. It's a structural budget deficit. We don't get away from it with just fuel taxes.
Add to that, the mayor in yesterday's newspaper, they talked about he'd done the State of the City and said that our system is broken when it comes to paying for our fire and police departments because everyone's going and shopping online and mm-hmm. cities are no longer. Is it more that we need to just figure this thing out to be more 21st century? And what kind of leadership is that going to take to just completely overhaul our tax system?
There's no question. We're at a different moment in time, and we have to have a different mindset on how we address government at all levels. I mean, the municipalities have the pressure on them because of the problem with the sales tax, like you say. The state is got this chronic budget hole that is not going away. And you're right, Ryan. I mean, there's no quick fix, but in tandem with looking at how we look for more money, we also, I think, still have a legislature that is going to be focused on looking at where we can do some things to streamline or not necessarily make radical, you know, indiscriminate cuts in places where we know more money is needed. And no one argues that there are some big agencies with big needs in funding. But we're going to have to, it's going to have to be both sides of the equation. I think that the idea that we're just going to find more money and continue to grow a budget is not going to work. We're going to have something that the public can buy into and believe that needs are being met, but that they're not just going to be gouged and taxed to the limit to get it done.
You know, our budget hasn't grown. I mean, since 2009, we're 15.1% off of the budget that was passed in 2009, adjusted for inflation. And so we've shrunk our budget. I mean, we have streamlined agencies to the point of, you know, it's not a matter of, you know, putting a Band-Aid on things. You got to put a tourniquet on it. They're actually hemorrhaging services that are provided to the people of Oklahoma. And it's gone beyond, you know, menial quality of life things to actual living or dying. When we look at rural hospitals that are in jeopardy of closing, when we have a fifth of our state schools that are on a four-day school week, and you know, when you talk about superintendents and legislators looking at stuff like that, they're not really talking about the pedagogical benefit of going to a four-day school week. It's all dollars and cents at this point. So this is a very dangerous time for the state of Oklahoma. I am encouraged that for maybe the first time in my entire political lifetime in Oklahoma, you're hearing lawmakers, Democratic and Republican lawmakers, talking about revenue raising measures. Mm-hmm. But they, you know, what they should realize is that they're saying this: the sky's not falling. Nobody's showing up at the Capitol with pitchforks. They need to go a step further and look at income tax.
But we're also in a situation where, with a $6 billion budget, I mean, and we have five agencies basically taking 80% of that budget, the five, you know, the five big areas, then we have to look at those. And I think one of the things that has to be discussed is within those areas, are there places where they can do some streamlining, some efficiencies, some cutting if necessary, so that it's not just one-sided. It's not just the more money, it's getting money where it needs to go, but also being purely accountable and having this transparency that we all talk about, that we really see that these agencies are doing with the dollars what really needs to be done. And I think when the public believes that their money's being well spent, I've always maintained it's less about the public being willing to pay for services, but they have to believe that the services are really being rendered and being done in an efficient way.
Well, let's get into that, because the agencies getting the lion's share of the budget went before the House Appropriations Committee over the past week. Education is asking for an extra $221 million. Oklahoma Healthcare Authority wants $200 million more, and the Department of Human Services wants an additional $42 million even before the fiscal year ends in June. They've got to have the money right now, and the Department of Corrections, Joe Albaugh, already said that he needs $1 billion just to get by, just to, you know, pay for these things. Ryan, your thoughts on what we're talking about, these budget hearings?
Well, and it's not even for the next fiscal year. I mean, DHS is asking for $42 million
right,
to cover
right now,
this fiscal year.
This year,
cover the gap between this year. Or they're talking about furloughing folks, and the people that will hurt there are children and seniors. You know, the elderly and the disabled and children are going to be the chief recipients of the pain that comes from the inability of the legislature to come up with that $42 million. I mean, these agencies are going to the legislature and making this case. They've done this year after year. And what my advice, and I think that one of the best people that's really modeling this is Joe Albaugh, is to stop going to the legislature and acting like you can get by with these with fewer dollars. I mean, they show up at the legislature and they seem to, you know, put a Band-Aid on everything, and they run the state with baling wire wrapped around it, and they act like everything's just fine when it's really about to fall apart at any moment. And we see that time after time. And yet the message that these agency leaders should convey to the legislature is that time has run out. We have to make big, bold decisions right now, and those decisions need to either be we raise revenue in a significant and meaningful way. I mean, we can fill the budget hole with these other items, but we need to really look at things like income tax cuts and increasing income tax in certain areas, in particular for the wealthiest Oklahomans, or we have to do away with these services. We have to quit living the fiction that we can have both. The current revenue model that we have and the services that we have, because we just can't.
And it's not all about just increasing taxes. I mean, there are a number of other legitimate areas and ways that they can deal with some of these issues. Bonding is one of them. I mean, when you look at the other two areas that you didn't mention, Michael, the higher education and transportation hearings that were last week of those five, you know, everyone, you're right. Everyone has a need. Everyone has increased needs and demands on them. But they also need to come to the table and say, along with what we need and the big, bold plan for the next decade, we need to tell you that here are some things where we're going to make some very dramatic changes, and we're going to do things very differently than we've done before, because that's always the missing component. And I think what we've seen in corrections with Joe Albaugh is, I think you're right, Ryan. I mean, he's come in and been very articulate and very forceful in saying, here is something that hasn't been attended to for more than a decade. I mean, decades, we could say, legitimately. And now it's completely broken, and what do you want to do? Here's what we can do. Here's what the price tag is. And then it's a kind of a two-pronged a proposition. Will the legislature decide that they're going to take it on and do it and then go back home and sell it to the folks back home, which I think they can if they have a plan? I mean, what's always been missing is the plan. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's always been talk about dollars, but nothing about how to get the job really done.
And we've got this problem with our electoral system as well, where so few people are participating in these elections, and the way the seats are gerrymandered, and we have folks elected in primaries with very small contingents of voters. And so if you ask Oklahomans in general, do you want these services? Are you outraged about this? They say yes. But the very same people that put us in this position keep getting reelected. And so you have people that have time and again rejected the idea of even talking about income tax rates being increased for the wealthiest Oklahomans, people that have talked about or refused the idea of eliminating the trigger for further income tax cuts. Mm-hmm. They get reelected. They get sent back to the Capitol by these small contingent of voters that are not representative of Oklahomans in general. So we've got this disconnect from the legislature and what Oklahomans are actually wanting.
Another Oklahoman is facing consideration to work in the Trump administration. Tulsa Congressman Jim Bridenstine has been meeting with transition officials to possibly be named as head of NASA. Neva, Bridenstine is certainly no stranger to space and security issues.
That's right, and I think that's why his name is being prominently mentioned. Even back before the holidays, we were hearing his name as a possible contender for the NASA administrator. And clearly he's in the hunt. Whether he finally makes it, I think, is anybody's guess at this point. But the fact that he went to New York, the fact that he had the meetings with the transition team and had these conversations certainly makes it a very legitimate conversation. And when you look at his history, even in Congress, two things. One, he had a self-imposed term limit where he said that this would be his last term regardless, that he would be leaving after this session. And secondly, that he has been the person that has really been out there introducing legislation that was really about NASA, about space, even saying that that this is our Sputnik moment, that we should look at sending someone back to the moon. I mean, he's been very aggressive and very forward-thinking on our NASA program, and I think the question now is that the place where the Trump administration will want to go, and they will be looking for the person that will trumpet whatever their focus is going to be with respect to space.
Ryan,
I would say Mars, not the moon, should be our target. But yeah, as somebody who has a deep affinity for space exploration and research, and America's leadership that we've had traditionally in that field, I think that Bridenstine shares a lot of that passion. He's somebody who has championed the agency, and I hope that if he is to receive this appointment, that he will be a vigorous champion for NASA. I mean, they are always in a fight for funding. There's a sense that whenever we have fewer dollars to go around, that's something that we can not fund adequately. But at the end of the day, Americans benefit and the world has benefited greatly from America's space program on just about any of the things that we use on a daily basis, from the computers in our pocket to the fact
Velcro.
I mean, the number of things that have come out of the space program that are just part of our daily lives, but also, just driving this idea of understanding who we are and what our place in the universe is, both literally and metaphorically, is an incredibly important mission and one that America should be a leader in. So, if Congressman Bridenstine does get this appointment, looking at his past, I trust that he would be a champion to move that agency further in that mission.
I was kind of jealous. I want to be head of NASA.
I do too. I'm saying all these nice things about him in hopes that, jokes. That's not why I'm saying
that. Hire me. I would love to go work for NASA.
Yeah.
The countdown is on for lawmakers to pass a measure to comply with the Real ID Act. Federal officials gave one final extension to allow Oklahomans to still enter certain buildings or military installations, even though current IDs don't comply with the 2005 law. Ryan, do you think lawmakers will get something passed to comply, or should they get something passed to comply?
I think that, this 2005 law that Congress passed was just another one of those laws that was, it was a reaction to the 9/11 attacks, and it really wasn't grounded in real evidence that this is going to make us safer. It's going to make us feel safer, but is it actually going to make us safer? And especially whenever we're looking at something that doesn't have any really, specific evidence that it will make us safer. If we're giving up liberties, even if people think that they're marginal in terms of the privacy and the federal overreach and creating a national ID program, even if people think that that's not a big deal, if we're trading that for something that doesn't deliver anything, maybe we shouldn't do anything at all. But even if we do something, you know, Senator Holt last year had created a proposal that would have created a real ID compliant ID. And then for Oklahomans that wanted to opt out, they could have another one. So folks like me that didn't want a real ID, I could get that and then use my passport to travel or get into federal buildings. So there's still some proposals out there that I suspect will probably get further traction this legislative session. But even if they don't, I seriously doubt whether it would have been the Clinton administration or the Trump administration that, you know, that Oklahoma is ever going to have a deadline that is held hard and fast by the federal government. I think that we, even if we don't pass anything, would continue to get extensions. I do want to mention that I'm such a space geek, going back to our last topic. I just got a notification that the International Space Station is going to be passing overhead in about 338 seconds. So,
everybody look up.
Everybody look up because you missed it.
Well, look up yesterday because we're taping this on Thursday.
Neva.
Well, I think the bottom line is they need to deal with it in the legislature. I mean, they have the extension. I don't know that I necessarily agree that these extensions are going to go on indefinitely. I think the number one focus for most folks is, are they going to need a passport to get on an airplane, you know, to travel commercial? And even though that doesn't take effect till a year from now, January of 2018, I think it's a situation where the legislature needs to address it. And I think you're right, Ryan. There may be more of a notion of let's have the best of both worlds. I mean, folks have an option. I mean, they can get the real ID and not have to worry about the passport or some other identification. Or they can do that. And it's similar to whether or not they want to get a concealed carry and whether or not they want to give their fingerprint. I mean,
that's an option too as well.
Yeah, so there's trade offs, I think, in all of this. And the liberty issue and the privacy issues are always going to be a concern. Those are folks that are always going to be at the Capitol when these issues come up because they are very forceful. I mean, they're organized, they're passionate about it. And so the idea that this will just kind of happen in a vacuum and it'll be a bill and no one will have any real controversy gen up around it is not true. But bottom line from my standpoint is get it on early and do something and move on and quit just kicking the can down the road because there's nothing good that comes from that. We see that over and over in all of these discussions that we're having.
DPS says even if we do get it passed, it will still, I mean, we'll probably get extensions because of once we get it passed, it'll still take a couple of years for
us
to be able to.
Right, there's an implementation time, absolutely.
But, you know, and I think one of the reasons that we keep getting these extensions is because the federal officials that are in charge of administering the Real ID program at the federal level recognize that the benefits are negligible. And so this idea that the urgency to get these deadlines imposed keeps getting pushed off because they realize that the urgency is really a manufactured urgency. States like New York, the state of New York, does not have compliant real ID in the state of New York yet. There are other states as well. So, I mean, if you look at not just Oklahoma, we're not just talking about our 3.5 million folks plus some change, but we're looking at some states that have enormous numbers of people that contribute a lion's share of the commercial air travel in the United States, that they would be locked out of these airports with their IDs as well. So I think that the urgency, because it's manufactured, because they know that the security benefits are negligible, extensions will continue to be granted. Now, if Oklahoma is like the only state, if all 49 other states have signed on at some point, yeah, then we might be in trouble.
I think it's how tattooing got legalized. Yeah. All right, that'll do it for us. Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.